Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, February 3rd. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Something super, Eastern Illinois University once again basking in the big game spotlight. From Charleston. Jerry's Pizza is a local restaurant, so national advertising was never in the plans for former owner Larry Keck. But when two former fans, Eastern Illinois football alums Tony Romo and Jimmy Garoppolo, became starting NFL quarterbacks, he got it for free. It's funny because both of them on national TV, when they were asked about Charleston, they both mentioned Jerry's Pizza, Keck said, while standing behind the bar at the Charleston VFW, which he now manages. That was kind of neat. He's not the only one to bask in the notoriety, not to mention free advertising, of Eastern's NFL success. Garoppolo is the latest in a surprisingly large line of former Eastern Illinois quarterbacks who have found themselves in the Super Bowl spotlight. As starting quarterback, Garoppolo will be prominently featured in the broadcast, and that means attention for one of the smaller public universities in Illinois with an enrollment of around 8,000. The exposure that the university is going to get, I don't know how to really calculate that, said Eastern Illinois Sports Information Director Rich Moser, who added that he's been contacted by Fox for information on Garoppolo and his former school. If you want to put a dollar figure on it, you're probably talking tens of millions of dollars in the exposure of what we would have to buy in print and radio and TV time. While Garoppolo may be the first Eastern Illinois alum to start at quarterback in the Super Bowl, he's far from the first to be featured on Super Bowl Sunday. The 21,000 or so residents of Charleston have had plenty to cheer about over the last few decades. On the football stadium in the center of town, massive banners hang with names and photos of prominent alumni. While Garoppolo's banner is still in the process of being added, there are a few names the typical NFL fan would be sure to recognize. Rod Franklin remembers vividly when former Eastern Illinois quarterback Mike Shanahan coached the Denver Broncos to a Super Bowl XXXII win over the Green Bay Packers in 1998. It was awesome because there was a connection where I caught a couple of passes from Shanahan back in the 70s. It was pretty neat to watch him go where he did. Franklin was a walk-on receiver during the 1973-74 seasons when Shanahan played for the Panthers. Franklin ruptured his kidney early in the 1974 season, and by the time he was back and ready to play, Shanahan suffered his own ruptured kidney, which nearly killed him. Shanahan also won Super Bowl 33, and his son Kyle is the head coach of Garoppolo's 49ers. The elder Shanahan has kept his connection to Charleston alive. He still has friends in town, including former Jerry's Pizza owner Jerry Myerscough and resident Gentry Hogue, a Packers fan. Hogue said he received tickets from Shanahan to see his Broncos play in Green Bay. Eastern Illinois' Super Bowl legacy continued in 2010, when another former quarterback, Sean Payton, coached the New Orleans Saints to a title in Super Bowl 44. And while he never played in a Super Bowl, Romo was in the broadcast booth last year for Fox Sports. Garoppolo, though, has a chance to do something none of his predecessors did, quarterback a team to a title. The fact that he makes his connection to the school evident makes it all the more special to those in town. I keep reading that he brings his Eastern backpack to the gym, longtime Charleston resident Heather Hogue said. That's exciting to think about this little small town, small school, and it's getting our name out there. Mike Smard tried to downplay how special Eastern Illinois' quarterback history is, but the fact that Garoppolo still carries around his backpack did mean something to him. Samard was a transplant who moved from Maine in 1993. He's grown to love the town over the years because of the friendly people who accepted him, unlike those he encountered in the Northeast. He's glad to see Garoppolo expressing a similar sentiment. That's kind of a big deal. That means he loved his time here, and I'm glad, and I hope every athlete that goes to Eastern, whatever they pursue, whether it's professional football or whatever their pursuits are, remembers this as a nice little town that they can enjoy. Also on the front page, in Dash for Cash, Londrigan Picking Up Speed, article by Tom Kasich. The two main contenders in this fall's 13th congressional district race, Democrat Betsy Londrigan and Republican Rodney Davis, had nearly the same amount in their campaign accounts 11 months out from Election Day, they reported last week. Londrigan had $1.143 million in funds on December 31st to $1.076 million for Davis. The two likely will be reprising their 2018 contest, which Davis won by 2,058 votes out of more than 261,000 votes cast. Londrigan is opposed in the March 17th Democratic primary by political novice Stephanie Smith of Urbana, who reported $6,700 in contributions and $1,300 on hand on December 31st. Davis faces no Republican opposition this spring in the 14-county 13th district that includes Champaign-Urbana and extends from Urbana on the northeast to Collinsville on the southwest. Although Davis has nearly the same amount in his campaign fund that he had 2 years ago, Londrigan's account is much more flush than it was when she was amid a five-way Democratic primary. At that time, she had $237,000 on hand. While most of Londrigan's $529,000 in campaign contributions during the final quarter of 2019 were individual itemized donations, most of Davis's $360,000 in contributions were from political action committees representing corporations, associations, and other Republicans. For the year, Davis got nearly $1.3 million in PAC contributions, while Londrigan, who has renounced most PAC funding, received $201,000 from political action committees. Londrigan's fundraising was helped by groups such as Act Blue, J Street, Emily's List, End Citizens United, and Bend the Arc Jewish Action, Inc., which served as conduits for individuals from around the country to donate to individual candidates. Londrigan reported $302,000 through Act Blue, $17,000 through J Street, $9,000 through Emily's List, $5,000 through End Citizens United, and $807 through Bend the Arc. A similar group for Republicans Win Red yield $58,000 for Davis. Many of the political action committees that contribute to Davis's campaign fund are groups that have business in front of his two House committees, Agriculture and Transportation. Davis got $5,000 from the Alabama Farmers Federation, $4,000 from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, $3,000 from Cubic Corporation, which serves the transportation and defense sectors, Verizon, and the American Hospital Association. He got $2,500 contributions from the Transportation Intermediaries Association, the FAA, the NBSF, WSPUSA, and CHS, Inc. Londrigan's PAC donors include $5,000 from the United Steelworkers, the American Association for Justice, a trial lawyers group, and the Equality PAC for LGBT people. She has said that she will not take corporate PAC money, although Londrigan, for example, accepted $3,000 last year from the Political Action Committee of U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky. The Evanston Democrat last year accepted $262,000 in PAC donation from groups including Verizon, Ford Motor, Google, the National Association of Realtors, and Toyota. And from the local page, Women's Orchestra display is worth checking out. Until the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music acquired the Anna Faye Heron Bush Music and Papers in 2017, records documenting Bulmar Curl's Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago were hard to find. Unlike the original Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago, founded in 1924 and well-documented, Curl's ensemble only functioned between 1943 and 1948. The Sousa Archives' new exhibit, Anna Faye Heron and Bulmar Curl, Mementos from the Curl Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago, which was curated by Nolan Valener, provides an engaging snapshot of Herron's experiences performing with Carol during World War II. All women music ensembles first appeared as novelty acts on America's stages during the country's suffragette movement between 1848 and 1919. During this time, major symphonies regularly denied positions to women, so these ensembles provided the musicians their only professional jobs. After ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920, numerous all-women bands and orchestras performed around the country to celebrate women's voting rights. These included the U.S. Talma Ladies Military Band, the Los Angeles Women's Orchestra, and the Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago. During World War II, many all-women symphonies in America disbanded because their members left to fill positions in national orchestras as the men went off to war. Carol, a nationally recognized cornetist and bandleader, saw the loss of these all-women ensembles during the 1940s as an opportunity to continue his career and formed his own Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago in 1943. Born in 1875 in Bohemia, Carol first started playing the cornet at the age of 11 after joining a traveling circus, and in 1889 immigrated to the United States and eventually took cornet lessons with the Sousa Band's Albert Bode. In 1898, Carol briefly joined the Sousa Band as its cornet soloist and librarian. After leaving, he performed with several other bands before forming his own Bohemian band in 1906, which regularly recorded under the Columbia, Victor, and Zonophone labels, and twice performed at the University of Illinois. Later in his career, he formed his Women's Symphony Orchestra of Chicago, in which Anna Fay Herron played. Herron was born and raised in Windsor and attended Illinois Wesleyan College as a music student and oboist. After attending a 1944 performance of Carol's orchestra in Effingham, Herron auditioned for the ensemble and Carol hired her for its 1945-46 tour. Herron served as the orchestra's principal oboist and its stage manager. In addition, she drove both the tour bus and instrument truck, distributed weekly paychecks, and occasionally conducted the ensemble's rehearsals. The orchestra's 1945-46 tour began in late September with a series of performances in Chicago. The ensemble then traveled to Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania before returning to Chicago in 1946. In a 2014 interview, Herron remarked, "We weren't women, we were young sprouts. The orchestra was all girls. A few of the orchestra's musicians were much older, like Isabel Lloyd, but most of our members were still in college or recent high school graduates. For many of the musicians, this was our first professional ensemble." Life on tour was constant travel, performance in cheap hotels. The orchestra typically gave 2 to 3 concerts per day, often in different cities. They traveled like a circus caravan, with most of the performers riding in the tour bus, one member driving the instrument truck, and Carol following in his own car, driven by another musician. Frequent mechanical problems with the bus and equipment truck made each day an adventure, and Herron's letters and photographs during this tour provide colorful documentation of her experiences performing with the all-women orchestra. For further information about the exhibit, contact the Sousa Archives at 217-333-4577. And from Environmental Almanac, it's time woodchucks get the love they deserve. Yesterday was February 2nd, and if you're anything like me, you have one animal on your mind, groundhogs. Will Punxsutawney Phil see his shadow? Soon, though, you're likely to forget about Punxsutawney and his species until next Groundhog's Day. I argue, though, that groundhogs, otherwise known as woodchucks, are the underappreciated squirrel of the Midwest. And yes, they are squirrels, the largest in Illinois. If you could use a refresher of what a woodchuck looks like, picture a beaver without the flat tail. Wildlife Illinois webpage describes woodchucks as stocky creatures with stubby limbs, a short bushy tail, and a flat head. adding the Illinois Department of Natural Resources description, woodchucks vary in length from 17 to 24 inches from head to tip of tail and weigh between 7 and 14 pounds. Males tend to be larger than females, but both sexes' fur is some sort of light to dark brown and lighter on the belly side of the animal. Their front paws have four toes, and their back paws have a fifth, and these little feet are about 1.5 inches long. Personally, I find woodchucks' chubby bodies, broad heads, and fanatic digging and waddling adorable and hilarious. A few years ago, I spent time at Giant City State Park in southern Illinois, city of Maconda, where I witnessed about 20 woodchucks all rotating around together, a unique behavior for them. According to Animal Diversity Web, woodchucks are solitary animals, so seeing 20 all presumably living together was very surprising. Curious about this scenario, I reached out to Kenneth Delhunt, a district wildlife biologist for the DNR in southern Illinois. Delahunt explained that while Giant City is riddled with groundhogs, they typically are not denning together. Rather, just so many of the species inhabit the state park that they can be found roaming and burrowing everywhere in the area. Woodchucks' burrows can be found throughout the Midwest, especially in prairies and along edges of forests and fences, and can provide small local mammals homes after woodchucks abandon them. Wildlife Illinois also describes how groundhogs digging helps to aerate and mix the soil, which could help keep essential nutrients for native plants. Woodchucks also hibernate in these burrows. In fact, they are one of the few true hibernating mammals in Illinois. During true hibernation, woodchucks' body temperatures drop from 97 to 34 degrees, and their respiratory rates drop to one breath every 6 minutes and four heartbeats a minute. In terms of woodchucks' relationship with humans, besides Groundhog's Day, the species offers both problems and benefits to people. Being burrowing animals, woodchucks sometimes tear up people's lawns and gardens. Also, the small populations of predators, such as bobcats, allow woodchuck populations to flourish, and more woodchucks mean more burrows. This reason may help explain the abundance of groundhogs in Giant City as well. On the flip side, the high numbers of woodchucks qualifies them as a game animal, so the Illinois Department of Natural Resources allows for woodchuck hunting almost year-round. For individuals not interested in hunting, they can appreciate woodchucks in nature like I did in Giant City. Woodchucks also provide help toward understanding liver disease and hepatitis B in humans. Scientists at Cornell University have studied woodchuck hepatitis virus for over 15 years. According to the Cornell Chronicle, WHV is very similar to the hepatitis B virus in humans, but it processes in only a few years, 10 times faster than HBV. Using this quick turnaround to be able to fully study the virus's impacts, Cornell scientists have discovered that hepatitis B can cause liver cancer and that immunizations of the virus can fight against getting liver cancer. Between all of the interesting facts, human benefits, and heck, even a national holiday, woodchucks certainly are not just pests in the Midwest. While many people currently do not think of woodchucks fondly, with increasing awareness and a little luck, more people will convert into woodchuck lovers and give this underappreciated animal the love it deserves. And from the business page, from tickets to t-shirts, Illini's Revival has cash registers ringing from Champaign. The game day bus from Pia's to the State Farm Center is filling up. We're getting 15 to 18 more people than normal. We've had some full buses the last couple of weeks, Pia's owner Chad Pitcher said. On a 7-game winning streak, the Illini basketball team is improving business at some establishments, even if it's not quite at 2005 levels yet. For each home game, fans gather at Pia's on West Springfield Avenue and board a bus to State Farm Center. After the game, the bus takes them back. Everybody's excited with the new players. I think everybody's excited we have a big man that's actually finally large. The recent success of the football and now the basketball team has also benefited some bars near Chicago. Orange and Brew in downtown Downers Grove is geared specifically toward Illini fans. Eric Schmidt, who graduated from the U of I in 1995, opened the bar about a year ago and features Champaign Urbana beers. We've had Blind Pig, Triptych, 25 O'Clock, and tonight we've got a beer from Riggs in Urbana. In Urbana, Schmidt said Thursday before Illinois beat Minnesota. That night, Orange and Brew also served beer from Minneapolis-based Surly Brewing Company. During Illini games, Orange and Brew sees an uptick in customers, especially if the team is doing well. Obviously, the Illini games are very dependent on how good they are. It's definitely picked up the last couple of weeks. During the football season, Orange and Brew started to fill up the season, especially for the Red Box Bowl game on December 30th. At the State Farm Center, tickets have been going fast, with two more games already sold out, February 7th against Maryland and March 1st against Indiana. There hasn't been an increase in merchandise sales at the stadium, Senior Associate Athletics Director Marty Kaufman said. It's possible that those could still have a slight uptick at the end of the year, but we haven't seen it yet. Money generated from licensing fees often lags by a quarter or two. Most merchandise is ordered by retailers months in advance of the actual season, and royalties are reported by the manufacturers, not the retailers. Merchandise sales did increase online in December, but Kaufman thought that that may have had more to do with the football team than the basketball team. Since we haven't started Big Ten play yet, I think those numbers would have to be attributed to more success during the football season and then some anticipation for the basketball season. So I guess the short answer is that it's too early to tell for sure, but we don't have any real measurable increase in merchandise licensee at this point. Kaufman said there hasn't yet been a dramatic increase in concession sales, but said comparisons can be tricky with the day of the week and time of the game playing a big role. At the January 18th win against Northwestern, we did start to see a measurable increase in both food sales and beer sales, with all sales totaling $50,000. We anticipate strong sales moving forward, knowing that the crowds are just now really starting to dramatically increase. At Game Day Spirits, two stores in Champaign, marketing manager McLean Stahl said he's seen an increase in basketball merchandise sales. Especially on game days, we're seeing a lot of increased traffic as well. He said the standard basketball jersey and the House of Pain shirt have been popular. We're just really excited with the way the athletics department is going right now, especially with basketball. We're looking forward to seeing where it goes in the future. And an article by Brett Kepley. For some students, voting has its advantages. Illinois primaries are March 17th, and we know all you folks are excited for the campaign season and excited that the campaign season will come to an end November 4th. For you parents, students, and education administrators out there, pay attention to the following. To fuel the younger generation with the excitement of the democratic process, Illinois has just passed legislation allowing anyone who is eligible to vote and is a student in school to be entitled to be absent from school for a period of 2 hours during the school day in order to vote. A student per this new law will not be considered truant. This school absence law applies to primaries, general elections, special elections, or any election at which a proposition is submitted to the popular vote in the state. The student school may specify the hours during which such eligible students may be absent. This law is applicable not just on the day an election is held, but beginning on the 15th day before the election day of such elections. Remember, Illinois provides for early voting opportunities in places of election authorities, typically clerk offices of counties, municipalities, or other public agencies. So, at the time of day allotted by his school, the high school star wide receiver may then run his route to the county clerk's office anytime within 15 days or thereafter before election day so as to break the plane of the ballot box with his ballot, hopefully without interference from Russia. And indeed, it may be wise to vote early, 2 hours may not be sufficient time to get through a line, especially this year where turnout may be profound, owing to the profound issues at stake. The school absence law becomes effective June 1st of this year, so will not be available for the Illinois March primaries. By the way, on election days, employees in Illinois are entitled to a 2-hour leave from work without penalty for voting in general, special or proposition elections with at least 1 day's notice to the employer. In primary elections, it is only with the employer's consent does an employee then have the right to take 2 hours off to vote. The intent of the school law is to spur younger folks to get plugged into participating in the voting process. Interestingly, the law does not define school. Thus, can school under this law include a university or other secondary education beyond high school? If this law had been around in my day, I would have declared to my law school professor that I could lawfully skip his constitutional law class for 2 hours so I could exercise my constitutional right to vote. Regardless of the definition of school, one must be at least 18 years old to vote. In Illinois, a 17-year-old can vote in a primary if they would be 18 by the date of the following general election. With the length and intensity of campaigns these days, a 17-year-old might feel like 30 by the time the general election gets here in November. Monticello store sports classic look. If you prefer to shop vintage rather than new, here's a new store to check out. Sticks and Stones Vintage Upcycling and Curiosities at 206 West Washington Street in Monticello. Owner Lori Trotter said she buys estates and contents of warehouses that go up for auction and sells the items at her shop, which opened in December. She refinishes a lot of the furniture she sells. The store also has such things as candles, costume jewelry, glassware, anything vintage. Store hours are 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., 7 days a week. Kirby Medical Center in Monticello has opened its first retail pharmacy. It's called Kirby RX, and it's in the hospital gift shop's former space. The gift shop has moved into a larger space next to the pharmacy, according to the hospital CEO Steve Tenhouse. Kirby RX is open from 7:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 7:30 to 4:30 p.m. on Friday, and 8:30 to 12:30 p.m. on Saturday. And Waypoint Analytical plans to celebrate its new location at 2902 Farber Drive in Champaign on Tuesday. There will be a ribbon-cutting ceremony. The move to a larger space was done in anticipation of a larger influx of soil samples. The Champaign location, which does soil and plant tissue testing, is one of 14 sites for the Memphis-based Waypoint Analytical. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, February 3rd. Please stay tuned.